125 years ago, in 1889, Jules Verne wrote The Purchase of the North Pole, an adventure novel that opens with news that the Arctic region was going to be sold at auction for the benefit of the highest bidder. Well, recently, truth has been turning out to be stranger than fiction. As polar ice melts, competition is heating up for the rights to Arctic resources. And that's just one area of climate change in which nations and others see potential business opportunities. Journalist Mackenzie Funk looks at the ways some hope to profit from climate change in his book Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming. It's published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mackenzie Funk back to our show. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of the debate over climate change is still about what's actually happening and how we might reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Are investors and businesses treating that debate as effectively resolved? Have they concluded that most of our effort is going to be in adaptation to warming?
I think investors, insofar as they're paying attention, have realized that we're going to have to adapt no matter what. We've got enough warming baked into the system that it's going to happen. It's going to warm. So that's one half of the equation, and yet we can't, if we keep on emitting as much as we have, it's just going to get worse. It's not like we're going to either have warming or not. It's a spectrum.
So the business community would be split between people like the Koch brothers who deny that there's global warming and others who say, oh, here's an opportunity for me to make some real money.
Yeah, certainly I think people are beginning to look at this and say, well, this is the biggest thing we've ever done. This is the biggest market mover we've ever seen. Let's get on the high ground.
In the past, investing in climate change meant financing the fight against global warming, clean energy, carbon trading, carbon capture, etc. If investors and innovators are now focusing on adaptations, does that mean that business is being diverted away from the efforts to mitigate change?
I don't know the answer to that entirely, but I don't think that's not necessarily the case. There is money being spent on adaptation. I think actually still most of the money is going toward green technology. That's still what people think about when they think about climate change. It's just that now people are waking up to the fact that, yes, this is going to happen no matter what we do. And it's smart to invest in failure too.
You're right that there was a huge jump of water investment around 2007 after the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report came out and an Inconvenient Truth was released. There were all these new mutual funds and different investment schemes involving water. As a direct result of that?
I think water's been very hard to invest in for a very long time. It's because it's usually, you think of municipal utilities, they're usually controlled by the government. Investors look at water and they say, well, how can we really get much returns out of this? So, you know, it's been kind of a boring place to put your money, but it has.
Well, they have been buying up water in other parts of the world,
right.
In Africa and South America. And I imagine there's some people in California who are thinking, how can I take advantage of this drought?
You're very right. I talked to a hedge fund in California that is buying up water rights up and down the Colorado River system. The same thing is happening in the Murray-Darling system in Australia. Any place where you can buy the water rights and sit on them, that can earn you a pretty penny. And, of course, there are other technologies as well.
Well, have we seen major increases in investment in solar and wind power?
I think it's true in solar, yeah. And wind was doing well. It's not that people are betting on failure only. It's just that they're betting on both sides.
In terms of dollars, do we have a sense of how much is being invested in the United States or globally to adapt to or take advantage of climate change?
I don't have an overarching figure, but I think that we can look at, say, the potential cost of a seawall system to build New York City. You can get the scale of it. That could cost up to $10 billion or more. Imagine that on a global scale. It's a huge industry.
So when Sandy hit, the Dutch, I assume, immediately said, oh, here's a business opportunity because we've been dealing with problems like this for many years.
They were already here before Sandy hit. That was the remarkable thing. I attended a conference where they unveiled their seawall design, and, of course, nobody paid any attention to it then. And they said, we can do something like we have for Rotterdam. We can have a big gate that blocks the narrows, basically.
I've talked to some of those people.
Yeah, and it's a very smart design. It has some upsides, such as protecting Manhattan. It has some downsides, such as putting a bigger wall of water toward Staten Island.
Yeah.
And they've been on this early. For me, what was most remarkable about Sandy, having reported the book as before it happened, was that this was perfectly predicted by all these scientists. They knew what would happen if the tides were high and a storm surge came. They knew about the subways. They knew everything. And this was out there in the literature. It was out there in the engineers saying, well, look, you need to worry about this and this. why don't you buy the seawall from us? But yeah, they're planning for it.
I don't mean to pile on Chris Christie, but I gather that he had been warned as well. After the fact, he made a big thing, of course, about helping victims of Sandy. But could we be better prepared for these things?
Absolutely.
I mean, do we have to build a seawall, or are there less expensive things to do?
I think there may be smarter things to do than a seawall. A seawall is a very hard solution. There are all sorts of soft solutions you can do. I mean, you've heard about oyster beds, I'm sure. But it could be things like buying out people who are living too close to the coastline. That's beginning to happen. Certainly you don't want to park all your subway cars and buses below the floodline in New Jersey. You wouldn't want to do that. But there are all sorts of smart things you can do, and there's a group, IPK at NYU, that's looking into these now.
So on the one hand, we have drought in places like California, and then we also have other people concerned about rising sea levels because of melting sea ice and the deluge in the form of rising seas and extreme storms. We have this Arctic thing that just hit us some scientists are saying is the result of the fact that it's not cold enough on the North Pole to keep that cold air up there as it usually has been kept up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the science is still very early on that, but it's possible that all these Arctic vortexes are related to the melt of the sea ice up there. That's obviously bad for here. The melt could be said to be good for places like Greenland, for instance, or obviously northern Canada, Russia. Anybody that has a lot of oil and had too much ice to get it before, they're going to be okay now.
There are places that relied on snow. This is a bad day to talk about lack of snow here in New York City. But there's concern in Sochi, for example, which is in southern Russia. And the Israelis have come up with snowmaking machines that they probably will benefit from.
Yeah, Israel, obviously, they deal with drought. And so the way that they came to the technology of snowmaking was actually trying to come up with the perfect desalination technology. One way to take the salt out of water, out of seawater, is to freeze it. So what they made was basically a giant vacuum. Make a giant vacuum, freeze, lower the pressure enough that the water will freeze, and then separate the crystals. Now that giant vacuum turns out the byproduct is snow. They realize there's a better way to desalinate, but there may not be any better way than this to make snow.
Desalinization has been a problem because it requires so much energy, it may not be worthwhile.
Desalination is a technology that is very helpful for places that need that aren't going to get water any other way. There aren't that many places like that, but they do exist. A lot of places could do well with conservation, for instance, and they wouldn't need the desalination. But it has two downsides. One is that it puts out this brine, so it puts out this salt, and it could kill sea life. And the other one, as you say, is it's massively intensive with energy, and that might mean more carbon emissions even.
Getting back to Sandy and storms of that sort, New York State has a huge shoreline, and New Jersey do as well. But New York isn't known for getting things done fast. The World Trade Center still isn't finished after 13 years. So is there anybody out there with a plan that could help us during the next hurricane season?
By next hurricane season? Well, I'm not sure. That might be too soon. But there are lots of things that aren't obvious that could help, and those are everything from knowing the mobile phone numbers of all your neighbors or having some sort of text message system to warn you about things that are coming or just having a place for a community to gather and in times of need. I mean, those are the things you find in a crisis. And Eric Kleinenberg at NYU has done a lot of work on this.
Well, WMIC put us up in local hotels, and then the local hotels went dark, and it was useless staying in those hotels.
Well, I'm sure you saw the photo of the sandbags around Goldman Sachs. That's a nice thing, too.
Mackenzie Funk's book is called Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming. It is published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You quote a fund manager saying, hurricane season is actually quite a positive thing because it allows insurers to raise rates. Doesn't that suggest that they're doing more than just raising rates to cover costs?
I think it does. And that particularly applies to the reinsurers, who are the insurers of the insurers. And various funds, these climate funds, we're investing in the reinsurers because if anyone has an interest in understanding climate change, it's an insurance company. And they do. If you look at Munich RE, Swiss RE, they say, okay, this is a problem. We're going to spend some money on solving it. I mean, I don't think they want more climate change, but insofar as there is climate change and there are more hurricanes, people need more insurance.
Well, from what I heard about what happened after Hurricane Katrina, many of the insurance companies just refused to pay. But that's another issue. After Hurricane Katrina, the conservative economist Milton Friedman wrote that the disaster presented an opportunity. He was talking specifically about school reform in New Orleans. Are there ties between business efforts to find opportunities and political responses climate change?
I think that's a good question. I think one strain you'll see in climate denial is often a very libertarian way of thinking. People, if you look at the sort of social science about why do people or who are the people who deny climate science, well, it's usually white males of a certain age who affiliate with the Tea Party and have libertarian thoughts. That it's often, I don't like what climate change makes me want to do. Climate change seems to suggest that we'll need to cut carbon and have more government intervention. So therefore, I don't believe
these,
in it.
And use these weird light bulbs.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of the ones I've been using all my life.
So there's that correlation. And I did look at a very libertarian thinking in the book. I'd say, okay, what would the market do? What would a totally free market do presented with this problem of climate change? And it's not automatic that people are going to just say, okay, let's cut carbon. You might do what people did would be farmland purchases in Africa for food. Food prices are going to go up. Okay, let's buy farmland and let's grow it. You might be in the water business. You know, the market, free market response to this may not resemble what we think it will.
Naomi Klein coined the term disaster capitalism to refer to the use of disasters to promote political changes that serve business. Do you see anything like that happening in what you've been studying?
Certainly, yeah. I think that I've certainly read that book, and it has crossed my mind a number of times that this is happening. I don't think that people are necessarily wanting the disaster to happen so that they can capitalize on it. I think that's an important point. I didn't meet anyone who said, yeah, let's let the world burn because I can make a buck. I think it's more that with the disaster in front of them, they say, okay, I'm in the buck-making business. Here's what I do.
So you don't see any villains in this story?
I don't think there are any pure villains in it, no.
You note a distinction between blueprints for change and scrambling to adapt. Can you explain that?
Sure. One thing that people are sort of surprised by is that a major oil company, actually many of them now, would be a strong believer in climate change and the science of it. And I'm speaking of Shell. Shell Oil for 30 years has had these scenarios, this sort of in-house futurism that says, okay, let's take two or three different stories about what the world could be, what it looks like in 20, 50 years. Let's tell a story and decide how we're going to position ourselves for that coming reality. And very early on, Shell decided, well, climate change is something we're going to have to deal with. And in 2008, I believe, they came out with their two latest scenarios, which were called Blueprints and Scramble.
That's 2008. That is 6 years ago.
That's right. And Blueprints was sort of the world as we might hope it would be. It's a growing push for green energy. It's less coal. It's basically less carbon intensive. It's greener. Scramble was maybe what we've gotten. It was a rush for energy. People going for whatever they can get. And Shell wanted to prepare for either one of these futures.
Well, has everything been put on hold because of this sudden success in finding oil in the Dakotas and Canada and the natural gas all throughout the eastern coast?
Yeah, that's a major factor. As you may have heard just last week, Shell said, you know, we're not going to go drill in the Arctic in the coming summer. The second part of the Shell story is that they were the first movers in the American Arctic in Alaska. And they pulled back, for a lot of reasons, including, you know, they ran their drill ship into the rocks in Kodiak about a year ago. Now, another factor is that the Arctic has a ton of natural gas. That natural gas is a lot less uneconomic than it was 6 years ago.
In fact, they're burning it off in the Dakotas rather than mm-hmm. capturing it.
But there is still a ton of oil up there.
Well, we're going to return to the Arctic after we take a little break. My guest is Mackenzie Funk, who's a journalist whose work has appeared in Harper's, National Geographic, Rolling Stone, GQ, Outside, New York Times. His book, Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming, is published by the Penguin Press. Stay with us for more. We are back with Mackenzie Funk. His book, Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming, published by the Penguin Press. The decline in the sea ice in the Arctic Ocean is one of the most notable effects of climate change. And the last time you were on our show, we actually talked to you when you were on an icebreaker.
That's right.
Up there.
I was on an American icebreaker called the Healy, and its mission was to basically claim our chunk of the Arctic.
Well, you begin the book with a description of a Canadian sovereignty operation. What were they doing? Same sort of thing?
Similar. The Canadians believe that they own the Northwest Passage, and all the ships that go through there should ask them if they can have permission. A lot of other countries
like
don't.
Like the Panama Canal?
Like the Panama Canal. They want, or more like the northern sea route that goes across above Russia. Basically, everyone, if Canada were actually the boss, and it may be, then everyone would say, can we go through the Northwest Passage? And they would say yes. And they might charge a fee. They might charge a fee for a transit help from an icebreaker, or they might just let them go. A lot of places don't agree with Canada. This is Canadian waters. That includes the European Union. That includes the United States. So there's a political fight. The way Canada decided to make its mark up there was to send troops and say, here we are, look at us. And they were shooting guns into the water, and they were shooting howitzers off, and we camped on an island up there for a while.
Which would make, of course, the moon United States territory if anybody ever went up there to colonize it. But a number of countries have sent military to the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
They're all making claims on the portion that abuts their country. In some cases, I would think that, like with Russia and Finland, or even Siberia and Alaska, there would be real confusion as to where U.S. territory ends and where Siberian territory begins, et cetera.
You're very right. And there's a raft of lawyers who very lucratively agree with you. Now, what you're seeing happening up there, though, is not anything close to warfare, though. It's quite the opposite. And the way I see it is, it's say you take your kid to a birthday party and there's a giant piece of cake and only five of the kids get a piece of that cake. And one gets a slightly bigger one, but they're still all getting cake. I mean, that's what's happening in the Arctic. There are five countries that ring it. They're going to be able to split it up, and some are going to get bigger pieces, but everyone's getting a huge chunk.
But aren't environmentalists concerned about the Arctic ecosystem? Are our governments and businesses taking any measures to protect the environment of the Arctic?
I think they are. If you look at, for instance, the drilling rush in Greenland, there's a mining rush there too. You know, they do have. There's people who live very close to nature, of course. They had sealing operations and they had whaling and everything else. So there's a lot of concern about what will happen when this becomes a mining province, when they bring in 2,000 Chinese workers. What's that going to mean for the country? And there are environmental regulations, and they are asking them to do, but you know, it's a dirty business.
And that's because Greenland is losing some of its ice sheet, so now it's easier to drill into the land?
There are a few things happening. One is the same stories in the Northwest Passage, where the sea ice is pulling back and there's a longer shipping season. So let's say you have a mine at the end of a fjord, you can get to it for 2 months of the year longer. Another thing that's happening is that same pullback of sea ice allows for oil exploration. It's just easier to find. The third thing is, in a few cases, there have been glaciers literally pulling back and new mineral deposits discovered under where the ice had been.
The flip side of looking for possible business opportunities might be avoiding possible damage. The New York Times reported on growing concerns at Coca-Cola and other firms that climate change is disrupting their business. How much of the investment is dedicated to preventing losses opposed to finding new profits?
I think it's still aimed toward avoiding losses.
Well, in Coca-Cola's case, it was about water supply.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have to buy up water in other places so that they can continue making Coke.
Yeah. Any company that's very dependent on water is worried about water. And that it's not just speculation in that case. It's protecting their business. Even oil companies, they're worried what could happen to their oil installations. It's not a linear, this is good for everybody.
But in the case of water, there have been some conflicts in South America because people have objected to the fact that the governments have sold off the water that they use.
There have been objections in Maine or Michigan, too, and objections in Canada. There have been laws to say you can't export water from Canada. It's a big issue. People think of it as, obviously, as something that's crucial to life. It shouldn't be a market good. and businesses think of it as an ingredient they need.
Does investment for protection or adaptation mostly go to wealthier regions within a country or internationally?
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. You know, in reporting this book, I went to 24 different countries over the course of 6 years, and it didn't hit me immediately. But what I saw as I went is how different it is for the rich countries and the poor countries. You know, climate change is something that was mostly caused by the rich so far. We've emitted the most.
And yet we're going to cash in on it.
We're going to cash in, or at least we're going to be able to defend ourselves. We'll be able to pay for that seawall here. Can you imagine Bangladesh finding $10 billion to ring their country? No.
If there's no profit for businesses in adaptation by poorer countries, does that mean that those countries are just out of luck?
I don't think there's no profit, but I also think there's important work being done by aid groups. Now, if you go to Bangladesh, they're not just sitting there lying on their backs waiting for the water to come. They're doing quite a bit. They're doing quite a bit locally. They're doing quite a bit with international help. So there will be adaptation on a small scale, too.
Although Bangladesh has been vulnerable to floods for a very long time, pretty much throughout its history.
Yeah. The big change that's happening in Bangladesh is not just their floods or cyclones, which are worse. They're maybe bigger, but they've always been there. One thing that is happening is salt water. The salinity will creep up farther and farther, and it kills the crops. So the first thing that's happening is that you can't grow rice in certain areas where you always could. And if you can't grow rice, you can't live in that area, and so you move to the city or you try to go in India.
Economists like William Nordhaus have argued for a range of solutions, including mitigation and adaptation, since the 1970s and 80s. So this has been a topic of discussion for a long time. Why are we only really starting to address it now?
Well, in the 70s or 80s, there was still a very good chance that we could mitigate, which is to say cut enough emissions that we wouldn't have to deal with these problems now.
So have we gone past the tipping point?
Well, we've certainly gone past the point where of no return in terms of climate change. It's happening. It'll continue to happen because so much warming is baked into the system. So yeah, we were in the 70s, arguably, we were already, some warming was baked in. Well, it was baked in. Now there's more, and we don't seem to be slowing. So there's going to be more and more adaptation the longer we keep not mitigating.
Why do you think there is so much more resistance to this whole idea in this country than anywhere else in the world?
I don't know the answer to that.
Is that just American politics?
I think
American
it's politics.
Business?
I mean, I think it's the sort of individualism of this country, the belief that we don't want the government stepping on us and telling us what to do. And people seem to...
Even if it's going to keep our children alive?
Well, yeah. I can name about five different examples in our politics that are the same thing, couldn't you?
Did the investors and entrepreneurs you spoke with express any interest in protecting the environment, or do they see that as someone else's job?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that, you know, when I say there were no clear-cut villains, a lot of these people are doing, they think, very important good work. To use the example of a fellow who was partnering with the son of a Sudanese general, South Sudanese general, buying up farmland there. He believed that the best way to help that part of Africa was to bring business there, not to have the aid groups come in with their sacks of food, distribute it. He said, look, this is a corrupt place. We need to find someone who's a good business person, who isn't corrupt, who's going to grow food here, and I'll sell it to the locals first. And I do think a lot of people thought they were doing good.
Because the alternative is often money winding up in the hands of a select few who buy big houses and fancy cars.
That's right. If you look at Deutsche Bank, which was one investment house I looked at, they had a climate fund. They had a very big climate fund. And most of that was mitigation. Most of that was invested in making a greener world, solar panels and whatnot. A portion of it was going to adaptation. And so they were playing both sides. But they were certainly – those were as starry-eyed as bankers as you could get.
You would think that solar panels would work very well in equatorial countries in Africa and South America. But have we seen much of that happening?
You know, I didn't look too carefully at this, but yeah, I've seen them quite a bit. Distributed power, the idea that individuals can do their own electrical stuff is great. In places that don't have a grid, it's like mobile phones. You know, you've got your entire thing with you and it's portable.
Last year, the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide hit 400 parts per million, a level many consider a milestone. Even if we can adapt and do so profitably, is there a level of climate change that business leaders think we have to prevent?
I think the average business leader is already, if they're paying attention to climate change, they're already afraid of the effects. I don't think that I don't think they have some magic number out there. And to be clear, neither do scientists. You know, we've said 350 parts per million. We've said 400. You can pick your number. The science is a little bit unclear. But I think what businesses don't like is uncertainty. Regulatory uncertainty, climatic uncertainty, all of that is quite bad. So if you're betting on success, betting on failure, you want to know what you're going to get.
And certainty has been a big is something that farmers have relied on. Mm-hmm. There's a rainy season. But it's easy to imagine longer growing seasons or changes in rainfall. And that can be a real problem throughout the world, can't it? We could face famine in some parts of the world on a level that we haven't seen.
Yeah, in 2008, there was what we called the global food crisis. We kind of forgot about that because the economic crisis hit. But that was food riots all over the world. You know, some places I visited, Senegal, Bangladesh, that probably 30 countries were having bread riots. Now, that was connected to the drought in Australia, which was a major rice exporter. Australia had such a bad drought that it stopped exporting rice. That made food prices go up, and it had a knock-on effect. That was one of many factors. But it was, you can see this happening. And obviously, investors started moving into farmland at that same moment. So you could say they're solving a problem. You could also say they're profiteering. It's a little bit of both.
Well, a team of Columbia's Earth Institute published a study in 2011 that argued that climate cycles are driving wars. Is the defense industry taking an interest in climate change?
Quite a bit. You know, I noticed that Boeing, for instance, is looking a little bit at geoengineering technologies. They have someone on a working group there. That's because geoengineering being the way to reverse engineer the Earth's climate, to shoot, say, sulfur particles into the sky, mimic a volcano, and it'll cool the Earth. Now, one way to get that sulfur up there would be missiles, or more likely jets. Jets most likely made by Boeing. And so that's one example among many. The military's been very, I think, like business. They're a little bit politically agnostic. They just want to know reality. And the military has paid a lot of attention to climate change in recent years.
And there was an op-ed piece in Today's Times about another kind of engineering, GMOs, mm-hmm. In defense of GMOs, mm-hmm. although many people are really afraid of them. But there's a company that's growing genetically modified mosquitoes and releasing them in the Caribbean mm-hmm. as a way to stop dengue fever. That's something that we might all think is a good idea.
Well, this is certainly one of those cases. You know, I'm no particular fan of GMOs, but the alternative in this case is more chemicals. Now, it's a company called Oxitec. What they do is they breed what the founder called super sexy male mosquitoes. Males don't bite. Only the females bite. And so the males are sent out there to breed with wild females. Their offspring then die as pupae. And it can kill the population. They've done tests in Brazil. They've done tests in the Caymans. They want to come to Key West because dengue has appeared in Key West, Florida.
Did you speak to people at Monsanto, the company most people consider to be at the center of the debate here?
Yeah, absolutely. I went. Monsanto is planting sort of drought-resistant crops. And in Belgium, I toured a facility that was run. It was Monsanto and BASF, the German company, where they were testing different rice crops. They were trying to come up with the right code for these resilient crops. And that can be not just drought-proof, but also, you know, high salinity. That's very helpful with rice. If the water's turned too saline because it's too much saltwater intrusion, then you've got a high salinity rice, no problem.
As you look forward, do you see any major areas that climate change, in climate change that businesses are ignoring because there's no evident opportunity for profit?
Well, I think you could point to tropical disease in general as an area that companies haven't paid much attention to. You know, we've been looking for a malaria drug for, 40 years? It started in Vietnam, and as soon as Vietnam was over, we were less interested. There was less upside for us. So you can see that right now, a tropical disease like malaria or dengue maybe is less interesting to big drug companies.
Even though it kills so many people.
Right, and it's a huge, huge problem. And if those diseases march into Europe, they march into America, and it's beginning to happen with dengue in Florida, then maybe we'll see more interest.
And that's a direct result of climate change because
no,
Florida?
It's not direct at all. It's actually not linear with heat. But there is an interaction between climate change and dengue, complicated but likely to spread.
One congressman said that people shouldn't complain about climate change because in New England they'll have nicer summers. He's from San Diego, and I suspect San Diego will have really hotter summers as a result. There's no upside to this, is there?
Long term, no. I mean, I think a lot of the things I've seen are upsides. I mean, the case of Greenland again is certainly an upside, but it's short term.
Mackenzie Funk's book, Windfall: The Booming Business of Global Warming, is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.